The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 683 for Tuesday, November 14th, 2017. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you are going to learn at least four new things each and every time we get together, because we answer your questions, we share some tips, we share some cool stuff found, and that's how we make it to our goal. Sponsors for this episode include the new BB Edit 12 from Barebones Software at barebones.com, stamps.com, where you can visit stamps.com, click the microphone, enter MGG, and you get a free trial and all kinds of stuff that we'll tell you about in a minute, and harrys.com/MGG, where you also get a free trial and you can shave yourself with it. We'll talk about that in a few moments as well. Here, back here in Durham, New Hampshire, after a weekend in Austin, Texas, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, back here after popping into Manhattan for a mini CES-like event, here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How you doing, Mr. John F. Braun?
Good.
Good. Good.
Keeping warm?
Yeah, I was going to say, it got colder here while we were gone. And we were only gone like 5 days or something. But, it's how it goes. Tis the season, as we say. Let's dive right in, shall we, John? We'll just get right into it. Phil has a question. He says, my AirPods, when connected with my MacBook, the audio cuts out for like a second every 10 seconds. He says, I surmise that it is my Bluetooth module in my MacBook. So, yeah, it could be that there's something wrong with your Bluetooth module. It could be something wrong with your AirPods, but it could also be a conflict between Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, very specifically in the MacBook. And you didn't say what vintage, but I think this is true for all, if not most of them. There are multiple antennas in that MacBook for 2.4 gigahertz radios, and your MacBook decides which one to use for Bluetooth and which one to use for Wi-Fi. And it will bounce that back and forth, prioritizing, as I understand it, the Wi-Fi on the most, on the best one for that particular connection, and then shoveling Bluetooth connections off to the other 2.4 gigahertz antenna. But of course, that could cause, if that keeps happening, if Wi-Fi for some reason keeps bouncing back and forth between the two, that could cause interference, especially given the tight tolerance in terms of, very little buffering and all that stuff with the AirPods, so that you get near real-time sound and all of that good stuff. So my advice would be, if you can, jump to a 5 gigahertz radio for your Wi-Fi and see if that helps. If it does, then that's where the problem lies. If you can't, maybe changing the Bluetooth channel, or even just temporarily, just for troubleshooting sake, reorienting your MacBook so that one side of it is sort of definitively closer to your router, and see again if that helps. That'll at least let you narrow down if this switching thing is the issue. I don't know, but that's what I think, John. What do you think?
I think I'm going to tell you what Apple thinks. And Apple thinks that you should read a support article called Potential Sources of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth Interference, which we will link to in the show notes. Just popped in there for you.
Cool.
And they talk about a lot of things you did. The basic problem is the 2.4 gigahertz is a mess.
Well, it's crowded. Yeah.
And there's all sorts of things. So your suggestion, and they hint at this too, is, if you can get as many things out of there as possible. I think that's, and they mentioned some other things. Some may surprise you that also generate 2.4, other computer peripherals. Again, it gets real crowded. So yeah. I think you have the best advice there, including repositioning things. I mean, that can never hurt, right?
No, well, it can totally hurt. But that's sort of the point, is just start, one by one, changing things and test and see. The nice part is, of course, the same thing that's very frustrating. This happens routinely and frequently. So it's not difficult to test for, which is sort of, you know, a blessing when you're troubleshooting things, but it's frustrating when you're trying not to have to troubleshoot and just get work done or listen to music or whatever it is you're going to do. So, yeah. All right, John, you want to take us to Karsten?
Yes, I will. All right, let's see. Karsten. Okay. My wife has her own travel agency business and upgraded from an iPhone 6 to an iPhone 8. She used her iPhone 6 with a wired headset, and she used the Lightning port for charging. All right. With a new iPhone 8, she can only charge the phone or plug in the wired headsets. True. Question, do you know of a way to still charge an iPhone and have a 3.5mm/Lightning wired headphone connected? I tried a wireless charger, but that uses a low charge and is not enough. She does not want AirPods because they do not always connect fast enough when she wants a client to when she wants to take a client's call, and they run out of charge. She places one AirPod back in the case and takes the other one out, but it does not work for her. Really prefer a wired charge and wired headphones. I tried all sorts of adapters from Amazon. They all charge the phone, but phone calls are not routed to the headset. You can listen to music, but not use it as a headset. Any advice is appreciated. And I got exactly... So this is the talk of the town when the 7 came out, because this is a feature that they introduced, if you will, and that there's not a 3.5mm jack for a headset anymore. And believe it or not, so I have one too, Dave. So I still have an analog headset, and I use the adapter that came with the phone. But as pointed out...
You mean a wired headset?
Yes, so I have a wired headset that goes into the 3.5mm to Lightning adapter that then plugs into the phone, and that works
which
great.
Which I guess is also an analog. Saying analog is not incorrect. I just wanted to kind of get frame
it. Yeah, but it's a wired headset.
Yeah.
Well, the answer is pretty simple. So I did the same thing. I bought an adapter, and I'm like, well, I should just need a, you know, like a Lightning splitter kind of gizmo. And
sure.
I saw one on Amazon, and I'm like, oh, well, let's try that. And I ran into the same problem. It has to be designed very specifically to put audio through one port and power through the other. And the device, it's pretty straightforward here. It's the Belkin Lightning Audio and Charge Rockstar. I don't know what makes it a rock star, but...
Well, maybe the fact that it does what you're asking it to do. I mean, you know.
but that's it. And I think the retail from them is $40, and you may be able to get it for less elsewhere.
That does it for me. $33.07 on Amazon.
How much?
$33.07 on Amazon.
Yeah. So, you know, it lets the iPhone 7 kids get in on the whole, you know, needing dongles to do anything useful.
Yeah.
Club, right?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, I don't have a dongle like that, and I happily can use a wireless headset, which is what I've been using for several years. I used to use wired headsets, but I got sick and tired of having to walk around with my phone. I like to walk around when I'm on the phone in the office. So for a while, I used a Plantronics headset, and now, of course, I use the AirPods because they are... in that sense, the best wireless headset I've ever used. They sound good. They work well.
But
they're not inexpensive.
And now you mention it, that was probably the thought process with the 7. They're like, you know, hey, all you dinosaurs, stop using wired stuff.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
And my last experience with a Bluetooth headset and, you know, we just had a Bluetooth question about problems with Bluetooth is, I'll have to revisit it.
Yeah, it works pretty well. I also, depending on which wired headset you have, you might be able to get one that has a charging port built into it, like those Pioneer Raise headphones. They are Lightning port headphones. Like that's the only thing that these will plug into. And in addition to that, being able to give it some really kind of smart functionality because it's got a chip in it and it's connected digitally to your phone or your iPad. They put a little port in the cable that you can plug a Lightning cable into for charging purposes only. So I can plug these headphones in and still charge my phone or charge my iPad. I was using them, the Rays on the plane last night, and they're great. They sounded charged.
You know what? The only thought that I have about that, Dave.
Yes.
Is that if someone like Pioneer could build something like that, couldn't Apple have made their adapter have a charging port in it?
Sure, of
and I think technically they could have, but
of course, yeah.
They so Belkin could make a product,
right? Yeah, they could have. Yeah. But they just, you know, I mean, there's a lot in that little thing, right? There's a little DAC in there and everything. So yeah,
I remember I think it came or was available for pre-order. I think at the last CES, and I didn't pre-order it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's another solution.
Yep.
She may want to give those a try.
Yeah. I'll put a link in the show notes. Good stuff. Yeah. Cool. In the last episode, we had some conversation. I shared my crazy theory about doing a wipe and restore on your iPhone as effectively a way to clean caches and functionally as a way to get your iPhone running a little more efficiently. And battery life would be improved. And sure enough, many, many of you have written in and said that worked. So I'm glad that we went down this path together because that's important. However, some of you have not had it work until you did something else. And listener Scott wrote in and he said, I tried it, but it didn't seem to make a difference. He said, but then I decided to calibrate my battery. And he said, but it only lasted 6 minutes after hitting 1% before shutting down. So essentially calibrating the battery in this sense, we're talking about just letting it run down until it literally turns the phone off and then plug it in and charge it all the way back up. We've had several of you. In fact, we mentioned it in the last episode where it went, you know, almost an hour before dying from one, and that calibration matters. But even in Scott's case, where it only lasted 6 minutes before hitting 1%, he says, now after doing both of those things, he says, my battery life is significantly better. And he says, my Bluetooth problems have almost gone away. He said, of course, that doesn't make any sense correlating with these other two things. So it might be something different, although it might not. Your Bluetooth problems might have been something where the wipe and restore helped. We've certainly seen that in the past. So, and he said he sent us that report after 5 days. He said his battery life is now very usable, maybe as good as iOS 10. He said, I haven't hit 20% in 5 days and I used to always hit it. So, and Scott, you're not alone. We've heard from other folks too. And and this is the crazy thing about experimenting. You know, you don't know until you have a control group. I routinely would let my phone die, get down to 1%, and then just let it die. And then, okay, I'll plug it in. So my phone was already calibrated in that sense before I did this wipe and restore. So I did both things and I saw this great increase in battery life. So I think certainly at least those two things are related to this with iOS 11. Perhaps there's yet another factor that we're not aware of, but I did want to share that. So thanks, Scott, for chiming in with us on this. Any thoughts on that, John, before we?
I'm almost certain that at some point in the past, so Apple still has a section on their site. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think in the past they used to suggest,
yep,
on a support page that you calibrate your battery, you know, bring it up, down, and up.
Well, that was true with the MacBooks. I don't think they've ever suggested that for iOS devices, but I could have missed it. You're certainly more in tune with knowledge base articles than me.
Yeah, I thought that you could be, but it's funny because the position now, I think, is pretty much that you shouldn't need to do it, but it's
unnecessary. That's right. Yeah. I'm not.
Oh, I still do it every now and then.
And clearly, it's a good thing. I mean, even if it doesn't help actual battery life, just running it all the way down so that you at least get a accurate measurement is helpful. But what
I like is that, so if you try it and then all of a sudden you see that the apparent capacity of the battery in milliamp hours, which several utilities can report, has gone up, then you can pat yourself on the back and say, boy, I'm smart. I calibrated it and I made the battery better.
Right. That's right. Which is like what
I think that happened once. And then I'm like, okay, well, I've convinced myself that this is a good thing to do.
Right. That's right. Yes, of course. And it can be like Lisa's phone was it. I think we still need a new battery for it. It's a plus size phone. So it had 2,700 milliamp hour, native factory battery life. When I plugged it into Coconut Battery, it said that it was 1,700 milliamp hour capacity. So way down. And I did the whole deal with it, both things, letting the battery run all the way down and come back up, and the, the wipe and restore. And that brought it up to, I think, like 2,200 or something. I mean, it's not great. It's not 27, but, you know, way above the 17 that it was reporting. So it definitely helps.
The guideline pretty much across devices is this: after a year, you should have about 80% of the maximum capacity available.
That's right. Yeah.
Otherwise, something may be wrong.
Yep.
And Apple may replace your battery for you.
Correct. Correct.
They've done for me at least once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the OS, I don't know if it still reports it, but yeah, or it'll say service battery.
Mm-hmm. Or on the MacBook, yes. It'll say service battery.
Oh, yeah, the phone. Yeah.
The phone won't, but I think that same 80% is, if it's in warranty and your battery has less than 80% of its factory capacity left, I think that's generally the rule. But if somebody out there knows better, please let us know. Of course, feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the best place to do that.
Mm-hmm. Despite the shenanigans of the cable guy earlier, Dave, I think I did hear you right in that you said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
I said feedback at MacGeekGab.com, unless you're a premium listener, in which case premium at MacGeekGab.com is the email address that you can use because you're taking the extra step and supporting us directly. In fact, I want to thank this week's premium subscribers, John. Those that had contributed, we had many, many, in fact. Brian D. did a one-time $40 contribution, and David Y. did a one-time $100 contribution. Thank you to you, too. On the monthly plan, $10 a month, James B., John G., James C., Joe S., R.E.L., Paul M., and J.C., and then on the biannual $25 every 6 month plan, Robert S., Neil L., Scott G., Brian W., Art K., Chris F., Daniel M., and Daniel W., doing $50 every 6 months. Thank you so much to all of you. If you want to learn more about our premium program and all of that good stuff, and you want to support us directly, we certainly would appreciate it. You can visit MacGeekGab.com/premium. It is not mandatory, of course, but for those of you that can and would like to, we certainly appreciate it. But between that and our sponsors, that's what it takes to put this show together for you every week. So you are an integral part of that. And thank you. I can't say thank you enough. So I don't know what else to say other than thanks. Yeah. Good.
Thank you for your support.
Yeah. Hey, something I wanted to talk about. We've been talking about High Sierra a lot, and it made some changes in terms of compatibility and apps and all that. And so it's forced a lot of us to sort of stop and think and perhaps do those upgrades that we haven't done for many, many OS versions. And Microsoft Office comes up on that. The Adobe software comes up. Because that was a change from Sierra to High Sierra. Many versions of those things just got cut out because of the way High Sierra is sort of addressing libraries and that sort of thing right now. FileMaker for me was that one. And we have been running here. We'd been running FileMaker 11 for many years, largely because the file format changed from 11 to 12 many moons ago. We are now at FileMaker 16, and we took High Sierra as a reason to really dig in and of course upgrade everything internally here to FileMaker 16. We have custom databases that we wrote for our Mac Observer contacts, And for Backbeat Media, really, our entire CRM system is something we built from scratch. It does, in addition to all of our customer tracking, it does all of our invoicing and billing and like everything. The entire business runs on it. And so we migrated that stuff up to FileMaker 12, which was amazingly smooth. It took almost no time at all. But now that we're on FileMaker 12, there's some really interesting things that that can happen. Sorry, did I say we upgraded to FileMaker 12? We could have. FileMaker 12 won't run on High Sierra either. FileMaker 13 and later does. We upgraded all the way to FileMaker 16. FileMaker 12 is the file format that we're on, but the version of FileMaker that we're on is FileMaker 16. And they've done some really cool things with it, John. I've been impressed. One thing that they've done is on the server side. So they've like the mobile experience with FileMaker is stellar, and they've really upgraded things both in the mobile client on iOS as well as the server software. Now they've got this whole PDF engine built into the servers, so you can create PDFs from your mobile apps. You can sign PDFs and create that happening inside of FileMaker. All kinds of, I mean, it's crazy how well that works now, and it's just smooth. For those of us that create our own FileMaker databases, they've added two things that really blew me away. When you're trying to edit, for those of us, and I know we have a bunch of listeners who create FileMaker stuff here. When you're editing inside of the layouts of FileMaker, you have a lot of objects. Like you have like literal objects in the layout, like a label and maybe a field. And then maybe you would have a graphical object to have your background color and things like that, just to make it look nice. And it used to be really difficult if you needed to kind of dig in and click with the mouse just to find the right spot. They've added two commands: hide objects on top and hide all other objects. And it doesn't hide them from being visible in the layout. It just hides them while you're editing, so you can really get in and see what you want. It's one of those things. You understand what I'm saying, John? Where, you know, you're trying to like edit something and you can't quite click because something else is there, maybe overlapping it, and you just, it's frustrating. So now you can tell it, nope, get rid of this other stuff just while I'm editing. I know it sounds silly, but man, it has made a huge difference for us in terms of
when you're
edits.
Designing. Yeah, what you're telling me is that stuff gets in the way.
Stuff gets in the way. Yeah.
Rather not see. So, yeah, no. So that's a.
Yeah.
A nice tweak to, so this is when you're designing the database.
When you're designing the layouts for the database, that's right. Sort of the visual aspect of it. And the web engine works really well now with FileMaker Server 16. It takes your layouts that you built for the desktop client and it's always sort of done this, but now it really makes them work well on the web. Like no difference whatsoever in most cases that we've tried. Which is great, because then it, you know, you can scale way faster.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the whole promise of web services.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you, you know, I used FileMaker Go 16 on my iPhone the last time we were at Pepcom, John. And I tell you this now, I wouldn't tell the person this that I walked up to, but I'm walking up to the booth and I couldn't remember the name of the person that I normally deal with. I knew they weren't there. But as I was going up to the booth, I wanted to say, hey, I'm Dave from Mac Geek Gab. And I normally talk to, you know, so-and-so. It's a pleasure to meet you. But I couldn't remember so-and-so's name. And so in like the 10 seconds that I was walking up to the booth, I pulled my phone out of my pocket, launched FileMaker Go. It authenticates with, at that point, it was Touch ID because I didn't have an iPhone 10 to do Face ID, but it authenticates with Touch ID. I typed into the search field the name of the company, whatever it was, saw it come up, saw the person's name, put my phone in my pocket as I was saying, hey, I'm Dave. I normally talk with Tim, but, you know, it's a pleasure to meet you. And it was perfectly smooth, really easy over even just over a data connection. really impressive that a lot of the stuff they've done here. And they've got, if you don't want to have to worry about hosting your own thing, they've got FileMaker Cloud now. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. That's their own service. They partnered with Amazon Web Services to do it. And then they've also got Custom App Academy, where they'll teach you how to do these things. I'll tell you, you do not have to be a programmer to create a usable functional database custom inside FileMaker. Most of the Backbeat Media database, I coded up some of the crazy stuff that we do, but and it's not really coding. It's more just saying, you know, do this with that, and a lot of clicking. But Greg Snyder, who was, you know, one of my co-founders at Backbeat Media, he laid out our database. He's not a programmer by any stretch. And he was just like, yeah, I want this field here and this field here and that there. And it's boom.
Can you do SQL if you wanted to? Or that's just not what they do?
I think maybe there's a way to do SQL-like stuff.
You know, like queries.
But you can do queries. Yes. You can do queries in FileMaker's own way. Absolutely. Yeah. And
so they have their own language, you know, some, you know, select whatever from whatever, where whatever equals whatever, and, you know, links to the tables, and then you get.
Yes, but you don't have to say select. You just kind of, what you do is you create a series of linked find requests. So yes, it's that, but you don't have to understand like the semantics of SQL to do that. That's sort of the beauty of it.
So they have their own textual language.
But you're not writing it out. You can do it graphically. You can say, okay. I want to find this and this, and then open a new find window and, you know, omit that from this. And it becomes this very visual thing. So you don't actually think about the fact that you're doing this and creating this very complex find statement. And the cool part is, after you do it and you do it all visually, you can say, all right, save this find. You're good to go. We keep looking at different CRMs and stuff, and FileMaker is the one that comes around for us every time because it's so flexible. Anybody here can, you know, edit stuff and put things in and really manipulate it the way we want.
And Dave, guess what? Answer is yes. How do I know this? Because Brian Monroe in our chat room, which you can find at macgeekgab.com/stream, found something at FileMaker saying, you want to do a SQL query? Here you go. For all you SQL geeks.
Yeah. I knew I had heard something about it, but
SQL is a standard that SQL is a standard for dealing with databases, and people like it because it's standard.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I much prefer back in my Microsoft development days, visual tools rock because
And FileMaker's always been this way. I mean, for, you know, whatever, 20 years or 30 years. It's crazy. It's a great piece of software. I can't recommend it enough.
It's been around forever.
They've been around forever. Yeah. They're a wholly owned subsidiary of Apple now, but that's not how they started life. But that's how they are now, but they run their own thing. I just wanted to take a minute and kind of talk about FileMaker because it's something very important to me. And I know we get a lot of email from folks about FileMaker. So I figured it's time to maybe, you know, roll this into the show and see where it goes. So, yeah. Cool. All right, John, you want to take us to Edward?
Edward's got a good one. I'm not going to laugh. No. Edward says, my wife dropped her iPhone 6 in the toilet about 6 months ago and borrowed another iPhone 6 from a coworker. She's now getting her iPhone 10. And wants to return the iPhone 6 back to her coworker. However, she has some correspondence in the messages that she does not want anyone to see. I'm not sure if he means the messages app.
Probably messages app, or it could be mail. Okay. Yeah, but
or
it
could
right.
be email. Could be okay.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, but I think what I'm going to say applies to both cases. She's very paranoid about someone being able to get into it, even if I do a clean install on the phone. Is there a way to do something similar to a secure erase on the Mac for the iPhone? I do have a copy of iMazing, if that helps. Oh, it helps. Helps them. You guys are amazing. Thanks for your help. No, Ed, you're amazing. So my reply is as follows, Dave. So for a device that uses RAM rather than a rotational hard drive, The concept of a secure race, and my interpretation of secure race, at least as far as disk utility is concerned, if you try to run disk utility, is when you erase a rotational drive, there are a number of increasingly complex steps that you can take. So one is, well, just wipe out the directory, you know, of all the stuff on here and ship it. The thing is, all the data is left over, and if somebody knows what they're doing, they could retrieve it. So another option is, I think it'll write over every piece of the drive with ones or zeros, or it gets more complex, you know, the different patterns and things like that. That's a secure erase. For rotational hard drive, Dave, magnetic hard drive, that makes sense. But for RAM devices, because of the way they arrange data, and let me see if you're with me on this here, at least SSDs, and I would assume the iPhone as well, the way the data is laid out, the erase in the device itself, I think, is going to do it for you.
That is, well, it either is going to do it for you or isn't, but you could attempt to do something along the lines of a secure erase to an SSD. It wouldn't actually do what you want. It's not going to go and write cells to, there's no way to address individual cells, memory cells inside an SSD, the way that you can address individual sectors on a rotational drive. So you could say, go write, if you've got, let's say you've got a 100 gig drive, just for the sake of argument, you could say with a rotational drive, you could say, write a 100 gig file of all zeros. And when you do that, it's going to fill up the drive, right? If you do that on an SSD, things start getting a little weird, and you won't necessarily overwrite everything the way the drive is. So there is no way to secure erase an SSD.
Some SSDs at one point would actually have a special command saying, hey, can you do with something called a secure erase? It was totally outside of the OS.
Hmm.
But I've seen mention of some that will do that, but it has to be, it's specific to very few SSDs.
It's bad for an SSD to you know, just write nothing, right? Because you get a limited number of write cycles for every memory cell.
Well, I think a lot of utilities, if you try to do a secure erase, it's like, this is an SSD, you really don't.
Yeah, it's not going to do anything. Yeah. So no.
But in the case of an iOS device, Dave, there is no option to do a secure erase.
No. And you could wipe your phone and restore it and give it to this other person. And if they really dug and really knew what they were doing, they might stumble across some of your old data. Now, two things. Number one, all your data is encrypted anyway. So if you wipe it, the encryption or the decryption key for the old data isn't out there. So I don't think you're going to get anything off of it. And number two, there's really no other way other than to take a hammer to that phone and just smash it. So it's
You don't have to do that. So there are two articles that I'll refer you to. One is an article from Apple. I'm not actually entirely thrilled by it. Well, I don't think it tells you everything, Dave, but it's an article that we'll link to called "What to Do Before You Sell or Give Away Your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch." And it goes on, use these steps to remove your personal information from a device, even if you don't have it anymore. The thing that you want to keep in mind with an iOS device, Dave, is that, so once you tell it, and at some point you'll get a step saying, erase all the data on this device. And once you do that, the data's gone, right?
Correct.
There's no way for a normal individual to get it back because it erases it, or it's, you know, removes the directory entries, but there's no tool that I'm aware of for your average person to pick up the phone then and say, oh, I just restored all your data. So,
right. Well, right. To be clear, because there's been some discussion in the chat room here with Brian Monroe. Yes, your data will likely still remain on the device, but it was encrypted when it was put there and the key is not there. I know I said that before, but I just wanted to say it again, just to make it clear. So somebody could get it, but if they don't have the key, because they don't, and you don't either, because you've wiped the device clean, you're not going to get the data. Yeah.
I mean, I verified this. The last time I, you know, traded in my phone is, you know, I went through the steps they told me and I erased everything. And then, you know, I pretended that it was a new phone and I started going through it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, the phone is like, yeah, who am I? I don't know who I am.
Right.
You know, I'm a clean slate. But here's the thing to keep in mind with an Apple device, and you and I actually went through this in some fashion, Dave, a while ago. You want to make sure that you disconnect it from the Apple ecosphere. So I wouldn't worry about the data. I would worry that you have not unassociated it with various Apple services. And they tell you how to do a lot of this, like unpair with your Apple Watch. Log out of iCloud. Log out of iTunes and the App Store. Now, the Apple article doesn't mention this, Dave, but iMazing has an article also called Safely Wipe Your iPhone or iPad Before Trading In and Reselling It. And they have an interesting addition that I think it's worth pointing to their article, because they specifically say, and log out of Find My iPhone. Because you and I ran into this, Dave, when I sold you one of my old machines. I had not gone through all the proper steps to disassociate my Mac from the Apple ecosphere. And all of a sudden, one day I'm running, Find My iCloud and Find My iPhone. And it said Lucas's MacBook Pro. And I'm like, that's interesting.
Yeah. Right.
Because it was the machine that I sold you.
Right.
And I guess I didn't either log it out of Find My Mac, or I didn't kick it out of my iCloud database. So it still appeared. Now, what they say, the way to solve that problem, so I couldn't, be evil and remotely access this stuff, is change your iCloud password, maybe, when you're switching things in and out. So even though I could see his machine, assuming he selected a password that wasn't the same as mine, I wouldn't be able to do anything.
You couldn't. Yeah, right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
So I would not worry about it. There are, between these two resources, follow the steps. And
I agree. Yeah. It once you erase all settings and data, no one's going to get anything off that phone. And even before that, they might not get anything unless they have the password. But settings, general, reset, erase all content and settings. And the nice part is, at least with iOS 11, when you do that now, John, it'll tell you to sign out of Find My iPhone when you do that.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It'll also ask you if you want to make a, last kind of final backup too, which is handy. So, yeah.
There
yes,
you go.
Yes. Cool. All right, Larry, while we're in sort of file system geekiness here, we will go to Larry, because there's some things that have changed with APFS. Larry says, you guys are mentioning snapshots, and that's the first time I'd heard about them. He says, I'm trying to partition my drive. Never mind. He had a separate issue, but he was talking about repartitioning drives and with APFS, and he said it was getting hung up checking, snapshot X out of 13, where X is the number of the snapshot. So that is making it take a lot longer than I have time for. So snapshots and really repartitioning with APFS everything's changes now, because with APFS, you don't carve out specific space on the drive. You just carve out one blob of space for APFS, and it's shared amongst all your volumes. So there's no fixed sizes on partitions, and it's just an important thing to remember. And I know we've talked about it on the show here before, but if you go into Disk Utility and you go to repartition something, really all you're doing is saying, take this blob of storage here and add another volume to it. And you can say, I want this volume to have, a minimum reserve size of X or a maximum reserve size of X, but it doesn't force you to actually carve out physical space anymore, which is handy, because you can have things kind of, malleable and move space around. Have you done any repartitioning, John, with High Sierra?
Nothing outside of it converting my volume.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. And it I know this is going to keep coming up. So I just kind of wanted to reinforce that message. So when Larry's question came in, it was like, yeah, let's just say it again. So you've got, I'm trying to think of the right analogy to use. Think about it like this. This is going to be crazy. It's not going to be my final analogy on this, but it's going to be my first one. Think about that you have a bag, okay? And it's a watertight bag, right? So you could fill that bag up with water. If you take, and that would be your one volume, right? And so if you fill it half full of water, well, your volume's half full. If you go all the way up, it's all the way full. And we don't go half empty because, we're optimistic dudes here. If you put another bag inside that, that bag's not going to really take up any room until you start putting water in it, right? It's just sharing the space of the first bag that it's inside. That's what's happening with your storage with APFS and partitions. Mm-hmm. Is you can put lots of little bags inside the one big bag, and they can all be the same. They can all grow to the full size of the bag. It just depends on how much water is in each one. The big bag's still only going to hold whatever the maximum amount of water that it could hold is. But you could partition it out into little ones, and they don't talk to each other because they're all watertight. Does that make sense? I know it's crazy, but, I like my extended analogy. I just came back from Texas. That's the land of the extended analogy. So,
I was doing what you were talking about today, in that I double bagged my groceries.
See? There you go.
I put one bag inside the other, and it took up nearly the same amount of space.
Correct.
Not quite, because it's inside of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the second bag was kind of like a partition.
Yeah. And you could have put a third bag, like two inside one.
But at some point, at least with bags, the physics is just how many times can you fold a piece of paper?
As many as you like.
No, I think it's eight. Folding it and then folding it again. I think the limit is eight. It's physics. I don't know.
Depends on how big the piece of paper is.
No.
No? Oh, there's
there is a limit. It doesn't matter how big the piece of paper is.
I see what you're saying.
I think the limit with today's paper is eight folds, or maybe it's less. I don't know.
Like, it depends on how thick the paper is. Yeah.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
Really?
No, it doesn't. No, I don't think it does.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah, it's a head scratcher. But anyway, speaking of head scratchers, I think Alan has something.
Oh, we're going to take a minute, though, John. I mean, this is good. Don't get me wrong. I like where we're going here. But I do want to, I want to talk about our sponsors, that's okay. All right. Our first sponsor today is Harry's, where at harrys.com/MGG, you can get a free trial set from Harry's. This is a $13 value. You get it for free. You just have to pay the shipping, which is just a few bucks. And you'll get a weighted razor handle. These things feel great in your hand. A blade set that is five blades. It's like a cartridge that fits right on the handle. It's got five blades in it. It's got a little lubricating strip to keep it moving nice. And on the other side, you turn it around, it's got a trimmer blade. It's also got like this flex to it. They've sort of engineered and evolved over the course of doing this. Really, really good stuff. I mean, they just keep getting better and better. And I liked it to begin with. It's really great. And then it also comes with, in this free trial set, you get their like foamy, lathering, rich shave gel, and you get a cover for the blades. So you can bring it with you when you travel, like I did this past weekend when I was in Austin. I know this is No Shave November. I used to carve in a beard or whatever, or just, kind of let it go, because it doesn't matter. I don't have to go anywhere and see people generally. You folks don't know what I look like when I do this show, so I could be a hairy mess. But I'm not, because I really like the way Harry's makes me feel. Like it feels good while I'm shaving, and it feels good after I shave. I mean, it's so smooth, so perfect. It has changed me. I used to be an electric razor guy for decades. I was an electric razor guy. Started trying this Harry's stuff. I think the battery in my electric razor is dead now. I mean, because I haven't charged it in, years. So you got to check this out. Go to harrys.com/MGG. That's where you're going to get the free trial offer, $13 value. if you're doing some holiday shopping, you can get it done early because they just released their special edition holiday sets that make great gifts. They got a button for gifts on their site. Go check that out. Really cool stuff. But for you, get your free trial. Go to harrys.com/MGG right now. Sign up for it. You're good to go. Our thanks to Harry's for sponsoring this episode. Our second sponsor for today is Barebones Software at barebones.com with the new BB Edit 12. Well, man, you know that BB Edit's an app that I keep open all the time. Well, 12 takes it to a whole other level, which is pretty amazing considering the fact that they've been around, I think, more than twice as long as Mac Geek Gab has. That's pretty crazy. They've got this dark theme support. When you're using a dark color scheme, BB Edit now colors your editing and project window to match. It looks really good. And, you know, they've always had this FTP / SFTP browser, so you can open up things from remote servers and edit them like they're local. And when you hit, you know, Command S to save, it saves it across the FTP or the SFTP link. They've improved the UI for that. It's way smoother, way better. They've now got an outline view there for improved navigation. You can preview things right inside BB Edit windows if you're editing HTML. They've got a new text extraction feature that extends the searching capabilities and allows you to locate and collect search results into a single document. It's amazing that they can find ways to continue to improve this and then show them to us. It's like, whoa, I didn't know I needed that, except I need it. Right? It's a very Apple way of doing things for a text editor. You got to check it out. Go to barebones.com. Our thanks to Barebones Software and all the great people there for sponsoring this episode. Our next sponsor for today is Stamps.com, where you can go to Stamps.com. You go there, you click on the little microphone in the upper right-hand corner of the page. I think it's in the upper right-hand corner. And you're going to enter in MGG. And what that gets you is a four-week free trial of Stamps.com. It comes with supplies, postage, and a digital scale. This is the time of year when we're all shipping stuff like crazy. Business, personal, all of it. You get discounts. This is the time of year to check out Stamps.com. And I've been totally impressed with it. Really blown away. I had heard about it, of course, before they came on board as a sponsor, but I'd never really checked them out. Man, you can ship anything. If you can do it at the post office, you can do it here. The nice part is you don't have to wait in line, right? You can, if you like to wait in line, you can go to the post office and wait in line, but you could bring your Stamps.com printed postage. You get the discount. And if you don't want to wait in line, you just, you know, drop it off there. Our post office, probably like yours, has a place where once everything's prepaid, you can just drop it off, or you can have them come pick it up for free. You can do it all from your desk any time of day. Literally any kind of postage or whatever you can print at the post office or you can get at the post office, you can print at home, including just regular, you know, stamps for your letters. Actually, you just print the letter. It has the address and the postage right there on it. So you got to do this. Check it out. This is the right time of year. Just visit stamps.com, click on the microphone, enter the code MGG. And that gets you the four-week trial and includes postage and a digital scale before you do anything else. Just go do that. It's really, really great. We've been using it here, not just to send letters, but also to put postage on packages, all sorts of stuff, certified mail, whatever you want. It really, really works. Check it out. Stamps.com. Click on the microphone, type in MGG, and you're going to be blown away, just like I have been. Our thanks to Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode. All right, John, you want to take us to Alan?
Alan's got a disk-based mystery, but we're going to solve it and learn something, maybe.
All right.
I use the utility program Mountain to manage my external disk drives attached to my laptop. It enables me to dismount all external disks with a single click when I want to go mobile. Since upgrading the High Sierra, Mountain has been notifying me of the mounting and unmounting of disks I've never seen before and do not understand. Preboot, recovery, VM, Watson at snap-704845. and so on. Watson, by the way, is the name of my internal SSD. Hmm. What are these disks? And why is the system mounting and dismounting them? I'm going to tell you exactly what they are. Well, at first, I wasn't quite sure. So you're going to have to maybe go to the terminal or disk utility. But I prefer terminals for this. But my reflection, Dave, is that this is, does something very similar to something that I use called Hardware Growler. And that's kind of how I knew what some of this was. And that it's also a tool that tells you about disk mounting and unmounting events via the OS. Or sometimes installers get sneaky, Dave. I still see some things do this. And OS things, like every now and then I'll see it and it says, yeah, I'm just mounting recovery just because. And it's like, okay, that's cool. And then it's like, yeah, I unmounted it. Or, yeah, I'm mounting EFI. I'm like, okay, which is the firmware.
Huh.
Because sometimes it updates it. So it's kind of neat to see, you know, what's happening behind the scenes. The OS is looking out for you.
Sure.
Or updating itself, or self-healing, if you will. But if you go to the terminal and you type disk util list, well, disk util, of course, is disk utility. And then list, it's going to list every disk and partition thereof, Dave. And now, these things kind of make sense here. So pre-boot, I think that's something new in High Sierra, Dave, or APFS. Recovery, okay, well, you know, I just talked about that, right? Well, recovery is your recovery partition, which you normally get into and has all sorts of handy utilities by holding down Command-R. VM, Dave, I'm going to bet dollars to donuts. Is virtual memory. I don't know why it's exposed here. What do you think? Or virtual machine? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I mean,
well, let me see how big it is. Hold on. Let me see how big it says it is.
Yeah. Huh.
Let's see. All right. It is right now showing VM. All right. So on my Mac Mini, it's showing VM as 1.1 gigabytes. That kind of sounds like virtual memory. Oh,
wait a minute. Okay, so it used to be, right, it used to be that it in Sierra and prior, virtual memory was created by way of creating actual files. Like the OS would start using files and say, okay, I need a gig more of virtual memory, so let's write a file that's a gig, and then we can use that one, and if we need more, we'll create another one. If we need less, we'll start deleting them. With APFS, based on our bags and water scheme, it's way better to treat it like Unix likes to treat virtual memory, which is its own partition, but because we can use another bag, it just throws another bag in and says, put the virtual memory here, keep it compartmentalized. And that's, it looks like it's exactly what it's doing. Because I've got the podcast machine here is a Sierra machine. So it still does it the old way. So when you just were talking about this, I'm like, oh, dude, I'm not seeing it. And then, of course, it was like, oh, yeah, ding, ding, ding. Got to look at a High Sierra machine. So I SSH'd into my iMac downstairs and I'm seeing the same thing. I've got 5.4 gigs of virtual memory or VM, which I assume is virtual memory on my APFS.
Well, it definitely is because I'm looking with iStat menus and it shows my swap memory is, well, it's using 520 out of 1 gig, 520 megabytes out of 1 gigabyte.
Oh,
but it is 1 gigabyte.
Yeah, so, there you go. Okay.
So it's absolutely what that VM is.
That makes sense. And that'll shrink and grow as it needs to, and it can do it inside the container now. Makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, which actually this machine, okay, this machine has 8 gigs, so I can understand it having a 1 gig swap partition.
With my computer downstairs has 32 gigs of RAM, and it's using 5.4 gigs of swap. There's still issues with the way Mac OS manages RAM, but we won't get into
that. Unix in general always likes to have VM, just...
Yeah. Oh, no, it needs some level of it. Correct. Yeah.
Like, remember, I think there were some crazy people in the past that said, you know, can I disable virtual memory and just run everything in RAM? And it's like, Unix doesn't like it when you do that. That's been my experience, because I think when I tried that, it wasn't pretty.
No, but
the OS reacts
unpleasantly.
The OS gets angry.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
All right. So I think that's the answer. So a handy little thing to see. And it also shows other attached volumes. So it's also showing my external backup. And it's like, oh, yeah, and there's, you know, EFI and boot OS X and backup. So it shows my backup drive as well. So
just so everybody knows, though, because we had another question about somebody was saying, oh, I see this pre-boot volume. What is that? Because we like to know what normal looks like, I'm going to assume my machine is normal because it's not, you know, failing on me at the moment. My APFS volume, my boot volume, has four partitions on it. Five if you count APFS container scheme, but that's not a partition. That's just sort of the thing. And then it's right. got four volumes. Let's not call them partitions because they're not partitions. They're volumes. And there's four APFS volumes. One is the actual, you know, the drive that I think of it as, which for me is Half Nelson, because, of course, that's the name of a Miles Davis song. No, I name all my hard drives after that. Right. And then there's three others that are hidden from me, except in this disk util list. And they are probably the same as what you have, John. Preboot, recovery, and VM.
Yes, sir.
And so that's okay. The fact that you're seeing that too. Now we know four APFS volumes on your boot drive is normal. And specifically preboot, recovery, and VM are there. It's totally okay. Don't freak out if you see preboot and you're good to go. So yeah. All right. That's
well,
good.
In this case, you shouldn't freak out if you see preboot, Dave.
Correct.
But
yeah, if it starts appearing on your drive, like if it starts appearing on your desktop, that's not necessarily a good thing. So,
and I want to mention that because I did have that happen, and I think it was a lack of proper cleanup code in a High Sierra installer, because I had a folder on my root drive, Dave, called preboot, and it's like, that shouldn't be there, or I shouldn't be able to see this.
Right, right.
So I threw it away. And now some may say, that's crazy, John. What are you doing? But I'm like, you don't belong there. No, I'm sure it was left over because normally the installer will copy a lot of things to the local hard drive and then reboot and then do something clever. But sometimes it doesn't clean up its mess.
Right.
And I think that's what right. some of us have seen.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Oh, and then snapshot. So the last thing, of course, snapshot is a new feature in APFS. So when he saw a volume at snap, I don't think it was saying, oh, snap. I think it was saying, here's a couple of snapshot partitions, I guess, or volumes.
They're just
I'm trying
snapshots.
To think what to call them. The thing is, I've run disutility under High Sierra. And if you do first aid, at some point it'll say, yeah, I'm just checking out these snapshot things just to make sure that they're consistent or they look reasonable. And that's the only time I've ever had a snapshot made visible to me, Dave, is through disutility first aid. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, that they I'm looking to see if there's no real way to manage these snapshots that I've found. But hopefully somebody, maybe Apple, will write a utility where we can actually start, you know, managing them from a backup
and I'm almost certain at one point, maybe it was creating one or doing something or changing the state of one, but I'm almost certain at some point, Dave, also at the root of my hard drive, and you may be asking yourself why you keep looking at the root of your hard drive, and it's like, because I can.
Because we're geeks, yeah.
But I saw a folder called like com.apple.something.snapshot, but it had the circle with the line through it, which means you can't get in here. And sure enough, you know, I double clicked on it. It's like, you don't have permissions to get into that. And it's like, well, what are you talking about? It's my computer, man. So I don't know why that happened. I think that may have been a permissions or visibility or something bug. But I saw at one point something, a folder that looked like it contained the snapshots. And it was made somewhat visible to me.
Yeah. So Alex is saying he posted a video on Facebook. And to be fair, I haven't caught up on everything on Facebook since my travels here, but he's saying in the video, the guy installed a bunch of stuff and then ran booted to the recovery partition and did like a time machine style restore to choose the snapshot to bring up, and it rolled everything all the way back, came back up almost instantly, but was, you know, where things had been prior, so that's how these snapshots can be used. And Alex is saying he could choose from more than one snapshot. So we got to go watch that video. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for sure. That's great. Thanks, Alex.
But at this point, snapshots are kind of an internal mystery feature in that I don't.
Yeah, I have no, I don't know how to say, like, take a snapshot right now. But yeah.
Wait, no. There, hold on.
Can you?
I mean, it may sound like we're babbling incoherently here, but actually this is part of our strategy, folks. Right?
Yes. But I'm curious where we're going. Yeah.
Well, no, I think we had someone mention to us that Disk Utility has additional goodies.
He's saying from the terminal, yes.
But I thought there were additional.
I don't know.
Commands. So
we'll dig into it. We'll find it. Yeah.
It still talks about journals. I'm looking at the...
Yeah, I don't see anything. I just typed diskutil space APFS on the command line, and I'm not seeing anything about snapshots there either. So we'll dig into it. We'll follow up on another show. That's good. Keeps things interesting. We do have a bunch of cool stuff found to go through, though. So let's see if we can get through this. I think we can. Starting with listener Mark, who says he's got two things for us. Cool stuff found number one, Beyond Compare. He says, I found this gem a few years back when I needed to migrate files from one server to a replacement, and I wanted to check the outcome to make sure everything made the move. Beyond Compare compares and syncs folders. It compares and merges text files. It works across local disks, servers, FTP servers, inside of zip files, inside of Subversion repositories, etc. It says licenses are available for single or multiple users. Their trial period, at least some time ago, he says, before he purchased the license, was for 30 days of use, not 30 calendar days, which allowed for a thorough shakedown. So very cool. We will put a link to Beyond Compare there in the show notes. I'd never heard of that one. That's pretty cool, man. So thanks for sharing that. And then cool stuff found number two is volume control. He says, again, it's still listener Mark, hence number two. I recently bought a Raspberry Pi 3 and configured it as an AirPlay receiver. This is a topic for another time. Changing the AirPlay volume was frustrating, he says, as I needed to get focus to iTunes rather than just use the volume controls on my iMac's keyboard. Enter volume control. An installer is available, and you can use the command key as a modifier to change the volume in iTunes while not affecting your computer's speaker volume. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, too. Very, very cool. I like it. It's good. Good, good, good. Yeah, moving along, John?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then we move on to Steven. We talked about VPNs recently. We actually have two cool stuffs found. Steven brings us to... he says AirVPN. He said, I'm trying to think of where we get here, he says, I choose to use AirVPN. What I like about it is that I can choose which port and protocol to use. Commonly, public Wi-Fi hotspots will block VPNs. He says, but I can generate a config, for example, using TCP port 443, which, of course, for those of you who don't know, is the port that all of your web encrypted web traffic, all the HTTPS traffic, goes over. So if you've got your VPN running on that port, chances are people aren't going to block that because they're going to want to let you browse secure websites. He says, I have a config for the very exceptional lockdown Wi-Fi hotspots, even on TCP port 80, which is where non-encrypted web traffic goes. He says, these configs are easy to set up, and they work over OpenVPN and are designed for a massive range of OSs. So airvpn.org is his VPN of choice. So that's pretty cool. I like the idea of running a VPN on port 443.
A non-standard port. Or standard port.
Yeah, just non-standard for a VPN. But just to be clear, even though he's talking about running these things on the HTTPS, which is encrypted web port, and HTTP, which is the non-encrypted web port, all the VPN traffic is encrypted. He's just using these ports because the hope is that these, you know, even people that are blocking VPNs aren't blocking web surfing. So, yeah.
Yeah, they'll figure it. If the admin's any good, they'll figure it out.
But, well, they could do deep packet inspection. Yeah,
exactly. If they're looking at the contents and they're like, oh, that's
an open VPN.
That doesn't look like traffic that should be in this port. So,
Right. Walter also is here and was talking about VPNs. He said, I wanted to add Mullvad, MULLVAD.net to the mix of VPNs you mentioned. It is not based in the U.S., and it is very privacy-oriented. They're based in Sweden, but they have servers all over the world that you can connect with. For some reason, he says, I like to have a non-U.S. option. Tinfoil hat time. For total anonymity, he says, you can even pay by cash in the mail in any currency, which is awesome for getting rid of those extra euros, pounds, or Australian dollars you may have picked up on vacations. He says, it's a little wacky to mail cash to Sweden with nothing but an account number. Seems dicey, perhaps, which is maybe, he says, why I like it. It's kind of a dirty thrill and works like a charm. They have their own app for Mac and Windows and Ubuntu Linux. He says, I think they just rolled one for Fedora Linux, too. You can also connect with an open VPN client. So very, very cool. I like this stuff. It's crazy. mailing cash to Sweden, John, for your VPN. I feel like maybe they should use Bitcoin, too, although maybe they do.
Or PayPal? Come on, man.
Oh, PayPal's trackable, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that is the one nice thing about cash.
Correct. Oh,
as
they
far
do.
As
they,
we know,
they
it's
accept
not...
Bitcoin. They accept Bitcoin, so you can do it that way, too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. As far as we know, cash is not trackable. Well, unless you consider the magnetic inks inside that RF receivers can pick up while you're
right
out and about. But I know nothing about that. And I certainly wouldn't suggest that that's even being done.
That's correct. That's right. all right. Now I lost where we were. I had a roll going, but then I got into it. Yeah, you know, I am... I have been a fan of the new breed of escort radar detectors, and we've talked about it on the show a couple of times before. I wanted to throw a new one out. The ones I've talked about in the past are they're not inexpensive at all models in the, you know, $500 to $700 range. And the reason I like those, what I really like, the feature I like the most out of these things is that they know my speed and they know the speed limit on the road and they can start alerting me when I'm going X miles per hour over the speed limit. Waze actually can do this too, but it's nice having this device that's also scanning for all of, you know, any radar or laser or anything like that. The Max series Escort, the Passport Max series radar detectors that I've tested before have their own GPS built in. They have a database in them of all kinds of little things that you can update, and they sync with your phone just to get speed limit data because your phone can look that up over a data connection using the Escort Live app. Well, the new X80, the Escort X80, changes this a little bit. Instead of it being a $600 or $700 detector, it's a $300 detector because it doesn't have GPS in it. It doesn't have any of the extra smarts that it doesn't need that are already in your smartphone. So you run the Escort Live app on your iPhone. It auto Bluetooth pairs with this thing. And then it's your iPhone that's doing the GPS to do the speed. See this, John? It's pretty cool. Yeah, I like
it. I was
going
to say, I mean, the speed feature you can get with Waze. And I constantly, I don't even know why I have it on because it's almost always red when I'm on the highway.
Yeah, but you can set it to only alert you when you're like 10 miles an hour over the limit or, you know, whatever you're, if you know your local, like here in New Hampshire, I know that judges won't take anybody that was going less than 10 miles an hour over the limit. So it's like, perfect. I'll set it to 10, then it alerts me and you're good.
Yeah, I think 10 is outside of the margin of error that I think most would consider reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, if you were clocked at going 1 mile over the speed limit, I think most would be just like, dude.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, they're not going to pull you over for that. Yeah. Not here in New Hampshire, anyway. I can't talk about your state. And you also have to look at the local laws. I think we have at least one state. I think Virginia still doesn't allow radar detectors used in the U.S. And then, of course, other countries are different. It was Dom in the chat room reminded me pre-show that Canada basically doesn't allow them anywhere. So, but this is a cool thing. I like the fact that it uses the functionality of your iPhone to do, mm-hmm. you know, the things that your iPhone can do so that you're not paying twice. And that's a good thing. What I really like is, you know, I think cars should do this more and more. We wound up, which is a funny story, but I'll tell it another time. We wound up renting a Chevy Malibu for the second half of our trip in Austin. Yep. We could use the My Chevrolet app to display stuff on the screen, but it didn't have its own GPS built in. It didn't have all that. And I was like, well, that's really smart, because why pay twice? So anyway, that's what I like about this X80 is you're not doing the pay twice thing. So I wanted to share that. Let's see, moving along to James, John, unless there's more on that one. Are we good on that one? We're good.
We're good.
Okay. James says, you guys were talking about YouTube downloaders. He says, the one I use is ClipGrab at ClipGrab.org. It is a Mac app that is a very fast downloader and converter. To use it, simply copy the YouTube link and automatically added to the app for download. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I like this stuff. It's fun, John. I like when I can pull stuff off of YouTube for offline viewing. It makes life easier. I watched something on the plane. What did I watch? Oh, somebody had put up the Geddy Lee interview that Geddy Lee, the singer and bass player from Rush, did with Dan Rather. I watched it on the airplane because I was able to pull it offline. These things are good. Moving on to Allison from,
of course, that Allison.
It is that Allison from podfeet.com. She said, I learned something, well, four things, during last week's show when you talked about Stay to help the doctor get his Windows to stick when he was unplugging a monitor and logging out and in. She says, for this type of thing, I use Moom, M-O-O-M, from many tricks to create scenes that I want to have static. She said, for example, I have one called Live that puts my digital workstation, her audio workstation rather, in the upper left, her show notes in the upper right, her chat in the lower left, and Audio Hijack and Nicecast in the lower right for when she's doing her show. She says, and then it banishes Chrome over to my non-primary monitor so I don't see the Hangout video. She says, it's also really useful when doing video screencasting, critical to get Windows not to jump around if you stop recording and then go back later to continue. That's very true. Yeah, if you've got something that's, you know, targeting a very specific section of the screen, using an app like Moom or Stay or any of those to sort of narrow in and make sure that your windows are in exactly the same spot, saves a lot of headache. So thanks for that. That's I love the guys at Many Tricks. Rob Griffiths was the founder of Mac OS X Hints before he left that and started Many Tricks.
So Dave, I got a quick one.
Yeah,
because it just happened today.
Yeah.
So shortly before the show, I noticed that there was a van for my cable company outside of my house. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And then just as I'm about to start the show, I see the guy pull out a ladder and climb the pole and start fiddling. And I'm like, you know what? I bet I know what's going to happen. Sure enough, Dave and I are doing our pre-show. And all of a sudden, the light on my arrow goes red and the lights start flashing on my cable modem.
And of course, no more John.
Yeah. So apparently I assume he was adding a new station or connection or something like that. He was fiddling with some cable thing. But anyway, so I got knocked offline. How did I know that, Dave, other than the lights and all that stuff here?
Well, and the fact that we weren't talking to each other anymore.
Yeah. And then Skype was going boop, boop.
Yeah,
boop.
Exactly.
But when I checked my email later on, Dave, which I could have done then, but I didn't. UptimeRobot.com. So basically, I have right here, Dave, 4:06 p.m. Uptime Robot says, hey, your DDNS is down. And at 4 or 8 p.m. and said, yep, it's back up. So just thought I'd mention them. Cool. I signed up with them at one time and I almost don't think about it because 99.9% of the time my connection's up. But I guess this pings it in 30-second intervals. And
Uptime Robot an app you run like on your Mac?
No, it's a website.
Oh, it pings you, not you pinging it.
Correct. And then if something's wrong, it sends you an email.
Huh. Cool. I get that from my disk stations.
Get a disk station alert.
No, I was going to say you wouldn't have. You'd have to be offline for like a half hour for your disk station to start complaining. Wow, that's interesting. Huh. So, I have a Fingbox, and I wonder if that would be a little more aggressive about it. We'll talk more about the Fingbox in another show. I'll test that before we do. Hey, I was a proud papa at the airport yesterday, John. We went through, checking in, going through security. I paid for TSA PreCheck for me a couple of years ago. Yeah. And generally these days when they've really limited down sort of the extra people that they just randomly give PreCheck to. But when I book a reservation, they generally give it to me and everybody else on the reservation. So and that's
I traveled with you once and I got it. And it was like, wow, this is how it should be.
This is how it should be. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. So, you're welcome. So the four of us had PreCheck. We go through and my son was in front of me and he's almost 16. He's taller than I am now. So,
strapping young lad there. You're not so young anymore. He's not so my young. Goodness.
Yep. So they asked him, they said, he put all his stuff in the thing. He knows what to do. It worked fine. He went through the metal detector. No problem. They said, do you have a cell phone? And he said, yeah. And he said, but it's in my bag. They're like, right. No, when it comes through, it's just a random check that the machine beeped. So you were randomly selected. We just want to take your cell phone and like wipe it down and, make sure there's no explosive residue.
Okay. Yeah. So they swab it and put it in.
They wanted to swab it. And he agreed to this. And so I saw him and, he once his bag made it through to the other side of the thing, he pulled his cell phone out and handed it to him and gave it back. And then as we were walking away, he's like, oh, yeah, I got to reset my my Touch ID. I got to type in my password. I'm like, why is that? He's like, well, as I grab my cell phone out of the bag, I hit the lock button 5 times to turn off Touch ID. He's like, I don't have anything on there I want to hide, but I didn't want them to be able to force me to unlock my phone. And he's right, because they can force you to use Touch ID or Face ID, but they cannot force you to divulge information that you know.
Well, hold on. So number one, what was the action?
Oh, yeah. So it's five presses of the lock button on your phone. Now, before you do that.
Wait, the lock button, which is the.
Well, it's not the volume button.
The power button?
Yeah, you can call that the power button, sure.
So if I hit that 5 times... Wait.
Before you do that, here's the thing, though. Go into Settings, go into Emergency SOS. On your iPhone 10...
It activates 911 call.
It can. There is an option in here called... And this is on everything.
All right, Emergency SOS. So I'm in Emergency SOS, and it says, rapidly click the sleep-wake button 5 times to quickly call emergency services.
Correct.
And auto call is off.
Okay. If auto call is off, then what you'll get is a screen that comes up that allows you to swipe to call emergency. If auto call is on, it will start calling right away. If you have the timer set, it will count down 3 seconds and then it will call emergency services. So just before you start experimenting with this, be aware. On the iPhone 10, you get one additional option. The emergency SOS gesture on this is to press and hold one of the volume buttons, it doesn't matter which, and the lock/side button, whatever you want to call that, just hold them down, and then it will go into this same mode. And you can, the extra option on the iPhone 10 is you can choose for it also to work with 5 clicks. 5 clicks is a little bit of a, it's a weird motion to do. It's much more natural to just squeeze the two.
I mean, the other head scratcher is that while I thought that if you were coming from outside the U.S. into the U.S., even if you're a U.S. citizen, then they could rifle through your data, but if you're traveling domestically, I don't think they can demand to look through your
correct. And he said he had this in mind from his trip to and from China earlier this year,
where there may have been a threat of that.
Sure. And so I was proud. I'm like, oh, that's pretty smart, man. Pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a child was not actually born.
I was just a proud papa, okay. Not a proud new papa.
Right.
That makes sense.
Because you taught your boy a rat.
Right. Yep.
Trust no one.
That's exactly right. Yes, that's right. We've watched the X-Files, man. It's good stuff. Yeah. Hey, I do have one other, I know the band's playing and all that good stuff, but I have one other thing to remind everyone of. We've talked about it on the show, but if you want to print or send a PDF of, say, an email to someone else, right? Like we wanted to, while we were away this weekend, somebody made a reservation for something and it was like a multi-page email. So taking a screenshot of it wouldn't have worked because you wouldn't get all the pages. And we wanted to send a PDF, but you know, that's not an obvious thing to do on the iPhone. The way you do it is you say print. So this was on Lisa's phone. She said print, or maybe it was my daughter's phone, actually. Doesn't matter. Print, and then go to preview the print. And then if it's a 3D touch capable phone, you can 3D touch on the preview. Or if it's not, you can just pinch out to zoom. And as soon as you do that, you'll get a different screen that has a sharing button on it. And when you choose share, you can say share it in messages, and it sends that preview PDF via whatever message you want. So there you go. That's how it's done. It's pretty good. All right. Now, we've told you all how to contact us. You can find us on Twitter. Go to twitter.com/MacGeekGab. We are happy to take your questions there. Although a much better place for your questions these days is Facebook, because everybody gets to see them. So go to MacGeekGab.com/Facebook and you can ask questions there. But we're happy to take things anywhere. We like to hear from everybody. It's kind of how we roll, John, huh?
I think. Right. Even rock it old school by offering you this thing called a telephone number.
Oh, we do. That's right.
And last I checked, Dave, the number is 206.
Nope.
Oh, no. Hold on. Wait. Let me get in reverse.
Okay.
You could call 224-888-GEEK, Dave, which is
4335. Almost made it. I want to thank everybody at CacheFly Hosting, CacheFly.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Of course, and then I want to thank our sponsors, which are Harry's at harrys.com/MGG, BB Edit from Barebone Software at barebones.com, stamps.com, where you click the microphone and type MGG for your free trial deal. You got to check that out, by the way. Really, it's good stuff. I want to thank Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. It's good stuff. There's some more coming too. Plex, plex.tv/redeem, I believe. Check the MacGeekGab.com/sponsors. That's where you can find everything. And we really appreciate it when you visit our sponsors and just check them out. If you decide to buy, that's great. But really, it's our job to get you to check them out. And then it's up to them and you from there. So MacGeekGab.com/sponsors. John, I'm rambling.
You're rambling, but you have a right to, Dave.
I think so.
Because, you know, you told us a little story here, and it made me very happy. Because you went to the airport, you had your son, he's on the ball. And the good thing, Dave, is that he made sure that he didn't get caught.
Made up.